It's an honor and a great pleasure for the department and the university to welcome you to the campus today. Professor Hyatt.
Thank you very much. Although I admit that I'm really much more interested in the questions which the chairman alluded to as being the subject of my current work, I feel that the primary duty of, at this moment, of any economist who is worth the title, is to tell the public and the students that the present unemployment is a direct and inevitable cause of the so-called full employment policy we have been pursuing for the past 25 years. And most people still mistakenly believe that an increase of aggregate demand will lastingly remove the causes of extensive unemployment. And nothing short of the insight that it is the means we have employed for this purpose, the constant artificial increase in aggregate demand, that has produced that misdirection of labor, which now manifests itself in unemployment, will prevent people in pressing for more inflation as soon as unemployment becomes at all dangerous. What seems to me the most important task to undeceive people about this belief that unemployment can be lastingly cured by just creating more demand. Now, I'm afraid this contention, which I believe a steadily increasing number of economists begins to accept, implies, however, nothing less than the assertion that the great majority of economists whose advice governments have taken in the last 25 years have been forfeited the right to be listened to in future and ought really to do penance in sackcloth and ashes about what they have been saying. Because that inflation has been brought about by following the dominating economic doctrine, the doctrine which is known as Keynesian economics. I stress Keynesians in the sense of the economics of a Keynesian school, because I have positive reason to believe that if Lord Keynes had lived, he would have become one of the foremost fighters against inflation. But he unfortunately died at a moment when the main effect of his past teaching, adapted to a particular situation, tended in the inflationist direction, as he himself told me once that his theories were frightfully important in the 1930s when the task was to combat an acute inflation, deflation, but that I could count upon him to change public opinion rapidly if his ideas ever should become dangerous. Now, unfortunately, 6 weeks after he had told me that it was dead, and the development of theories was left in the hand of his pupils, who developed it in a manner which I am not sure he would have fully approved. Their extraordinary influence has recently been let out in a publication which probably has not yet reached this country. There has just been published in England an interesting volume of essays on John Maynard Keynes, published by his nephew Milo Keynes, containing contributions by his greatest admirers, including Mrs. Joan Robinson, in whose essay we find the curious remark that he admits that sometimes they, his pupils, had trouble in getting Maynard to see what the point of his revolution really was. that they were pushing him in a direction which he didn't quite like, I think is beyond question. Now, what does it, did it really mean? It meant a scientific sanction to the popular view of the business man that what prosperity depends upon is sufficient consumers' demand. Generalizing this and raising it to the dignity of an economic theory, it became Keynesian economics and led to the belief that all unemployment could lastingly be cured by simply keeping aggregate demand high enough. And this view came to a victory by a curious prejudice about what scientific method really demanded. Before the Keynesian sanctification of the businessman's view became dominant, there had been a widely accepted view about the cause of unemployment, which I still regard as a true one, which was later abandoned. That view was that unemployment, extensive unemployment, is due to a definite discrepancy between the manner in which demand is distributed between the different services and commodities, and the manner in which, on the other side, the resources are distributed between producers and different services and commodities, with the result that there were, in each individual field, differences between demand and supply, which led to unemployment. And this theory has one great disadvantage. It claims that unemployment is caused by a deviation of the actual price structure from the equilibrium structure, which would produce correspondence between demand and supply in each sector. Now, such a deviation of prices from a hypothetical equilibrium structure is something which, by definition, cannot be statistically measured. We can only find out what the equilibrium prices be if we let the market under appropriate conditions work and establish an equilibrium position. But since we don't know what equilibrium prices would be, we cannot measure the deviation of actual prices from look. Now that had the result that a generation which was taught that new theory should be adopted, which could not be proved statistically, dismissed this theory as not scientific. A very curious procedure to say something, because we cannot prove it, must be false. But it rested on the belief that we had in our power to find scientific evidence for everything. On the other hand, there was a much simpler contention that unemployment was caused by insufficiency of aggregate demand. And there it was in fact possible to show statistically that there was a rough approximation between fluctuations in aggregate demand and fluctuations in unemployment. And although this was only a very approximate correspondence, it happened to be the theory for which we could adduce statistical evidence. And according to the current fashion, the theory, which was probably the better theory, but which could not be statistically discussed, was discarded, and the inferior theory, which was only an approximation, because it was the only one for which there was some statistical confirmation, came to be adopted as the ruling theory. And so we began acting on a theory which economists up to 1935 had regarded as a theory of cranks and beliefs of practical man, but undefensible scientifically, was suddenly raised to the rank of the dominant theory and came to dominate actual policy. Now, the reason why some of us at that time objected to this was that we had known from experience and knew from the theory which based on this that such a policy of raising aggregate demand at every moment sufficient to secure full employment involved a constant addition to the income stream which attracted resources to places where they could be used only so long as this addition to money continued to grow. It created jobs which were not additional in number, but which were at places where they could be preserved and maintained only by continuing and even accelerating inflation. What had suggested this to us, certainly to me and to many of people who thought at that time similarly, was the experience of the great German inflation, which I had watched from fairly close, and we had a good deal of it even in Austria where I lived through it, where during a very rapid inflation, so long as the inflation accelerated, there was no unemployment. But as soon as the rate of acceleration of the inflation slowed down, unemployment at once reappeared. It was exactly this which led us to recognize the effect of inflation on producing misdirections of the use of labor, which led on these past occasions to periods of unemployment, which we found, which we called then stabilization crisis, an almost invariable phenomenon at the end of an inflation period. And in developing this, we began to recognize that after all, the great industrial fluctuations of the past, the so-called business cycle, were just miniature phenomena of the same kind. Periods of 3 or 4 years of rapid credit expansion producing this misdirection of labor, in that case almost entirely in the form of an attraction of too much labor and other resources into the production of capital equipment, which at a certain later stage proved to be excessive and led to unemployment in, at first, the capital industries, then by a certain process of cumulative contraction spread all around. The point we then maintained, on which I particularly tried to elaborate just before Keynes became so influential, was essentially that the initial cause, even of the past third of unemployment, was not an insufficiency of final demand, but a misdirection of labor during the boom period, which when the boom came to an end, led to unemployment in this field. This unemployment then admittedly setting up a further cumulative process of contraction, unemployment now becoming the cause of real insufficiency of demand, that insufficiency of demand leading to further unemployment, and the whole downward spiral, which we know only so well. It was for this reason that from the very beginning I opposed the Keynesian proposal of controlling unemployment by an expansionist policy, by maintaining aggregate demand. I was convinced it couldn't last permanently, couldn't be effective only for a limited period, and would in the end make matters only worse, because during the period of credit expansion, it created more and more misdirection of labor. I confess that I never thought the thing could last as long as it did during the pre-war period. When the great post-war boom started, I expected it might be conducted for 5, 6, perhaps 8, mostly 10 years, but that we should lead into that great prosperity of 25 years with only minor recessions, never leading to any really deflationary interval in between. Well, that was something I did not wholly foresee. But I had not really, perhaps, fully understood that in the past, the check to the expansion did usually not come from any inherent cause that had already become impossible to continue but by external factors. The mechanism of the gold standard during the 19th century and early 20th century provided an early automatic check to expansion. We have removed that. We have, with Bretton Woods, removed another check by placing the burden of adjustments entirely on the surplus countries and relieving the deficit countries from ever having to contract. When there then became a danger of this expansion being checked, we invented a method of creating additional international liquidity solely for the purpose to prolong the period of expansion. And in the end, by removing fixed rates of exchange, we removed the last automatic check on expansion. And that made it possible to continue the inflationist prosperity for practically 25 years till the obstacle came from people feeling they no longer would put up with that amount of rise of prices which at that stage it brought about. But we are still in a mood where they believe, and in fact all the politicians still promise them, that they would get at the same time cessation of inflation and very soon full employment. Once they realize that this is impossible, that if you stop now inflation, you must get unemployment, there will be an outcry for more inflation. Now, that partly with a reservation in the people's minds that after all we can deal with the effect of inflation by price controls. And I fear what we are actually heading for is that the unemployment, which has now appeared as a result of checking the process of inflation, will cause such pressure on the politician that the inflation will be resumed, but that the protest against rising prices will force government to combine continued expansion of the quantity of money with extensive price controls. That will make the whole market mechanism largely ineffective, and that we shall get this worst of all possible worlds, a so-called repressed inflation, where there is too much money, but the increase of money cannot work itself out in prices, where in consequence the whole steering mechanism of the market is entirely suspended. I'm afraid I feel very pessimistic about the immediate future. I always add that, so far as this country is concerned, the one spark of hope which I see is that I knew from long observation that you people here are capable of changing your opinions amazingly rapidly, and that the present state of opinion, which forces a certain development, may no longer be the dominant state of opinion in a year's time or in 2 years' time. Then it would be possible to do what has been done in the past, that some skillful man, believing, not in any kind of very sophisticated theory, but who has grasped the bare elements of the quantity theory of money, which for practical purposes is still the most useful thing, although I have many objections against it as an adequate explanation, and will, as people like Hjalmar Schacht did in 1924, or Dr. Erhard did in 1949, just say, well, we stop the increase in the quantity of money and carry it out. The only doubt I have is whether, with all your willingness to change your opinions, you are prepared in such a crisis situation, if a suitable man should turn up, to give him the power he would need to carry such a program through. I'm not sure that Dr. Erhard, who really achieved a miracle in Germany by having the courage of bringing about a currency reform and removing all controls at the same time, could do the same sort of thing in this country. I think it's too much too dependent on the whole machinery of government.
I will just tell you, in conclusion, a joke, which, or not a joke, a true story, which Dr. Erhard loves to tell about his own experience, when he had decided and informed the other authorities that he was to announce on a certain day in 1949 that he was, on the one hand, carrying out a currency reform which involved the complete stoppage of the increase in the quantity of money, and at the same moment to scrap all price controls, General Mark Clark, the commander of the American Army of Occupation, came to see him and said, "Dr. Erhard, all my advisors tell me you are making a great mistake," on which Erhard smiled and said, "So all my advisors tell me," and proceeded with what he intended to do. I wonder whether there could be, with the existing American system of government, a man who would act according to his conviction, disregarding the advice of his advisors. Thank you.
If you could address your questions to Professor Hyatt distinctly so that they can be heard around the room, please. Professor Duke.
Professor Hyatt, you said you were surprised that we didn't have a collapse sooner. Now, by hindsight, do you have any explanations why we kept on going for 25 years? Why the collapse didn't come sooner?
Because for a long time, a slower acceleration of the rate of inflation was sufficient to keep the boom going than I should have expected. I should have thought, without any definite evidence for it, it's a matter of feeling, which you can't have quantitative evidence, that in order to continue inflationary boom of this kind, the acceleration of the inflation would have to start much earlier. It was a much more long-drawn process than I expected. I believe my rather unreflected expectation of a soon end was really based on the purely factual experience that in the past the check, which had come from external restraints, the ones I mentioned, had come so much sooner. There had never been in the past a real experiment of letting this thing go on indefinitely without any check. We were the first generation who had the courage in the belief in a theory, I believe a wrong theory, to remove all those safety devices which in the past restricted the discretion of the monetary authorities in order to enable them to act indefinitely on their theory. So we have for the first time tried it out, and it turned out that evidently that inflation, which is necessary, achieves alarming proportion only after a period of something like 20 or 25 years. It didn't then, but as I say, later than I expected.
If the policies of aggregate demand, increased aggregate demand that had been followed for the last 20 years in the post-war period, according to Keynesian economics, had not been put into effect, had not the world economy followed the same pattern of economic activity that it had before the war, which was one of high unemployment and perhaps low inflation?
Well, I question what you mean by had the policy been followed. In a sense, it has been followed. In total quantity of money, total income streams have continued to increase. If you mean, would it have been possible to increase them fast enough to preserve the employment effect which they had before, which meant a greater speeding up of inflation than had actually, now speaking not of the last 8 months when the thing has become so acute, but the last 2 years when the thing began to slow down and the unemployment to appear in a market degree. The great question, which I have no answer, is would it still have been possible by sufficiently speeding up inflation in this period to achieve or maintain nearly full employment. I just don't know. I rather hope that now it is no longer possible. I rather hope for the reasons given before, because if we succeeded once more to continuing near full employment for, say, another 2 years, it would add to the amount of misdirection of labor and would merely postpone the evil day and have an even worse crisis in 2 years' time. For that reason, I say, I hope we shall have to face the facts now and change our policies rather than another 2 years' time. I'm afraid if the politicians knew that there's still a chance of, say, recovering full employment for a few months before the next election, they would certainly try that and say, after the deluge, if we only can assure by a short spurt of near full employment that we are re-elected or that we are elected, they will do it. That, of course, is incidentally an illustration to a point I only implied. You know, what many of my fellow economists do not seem to see is that very frequently what from an economic point of view is only the second or third best institution may still be the best from a political point of view in the world in which we live. It may well be, I doubt it, but it may well be that the monetary authority, with complete freedom to act as it wanted, without any rules, merely doing the appropriate things, but completely protected against political pressure, would act more wisely than any kind of mechanical system. But in the world in which we live, the most important system is that the monetary authority has an excuse of saying no to political pressure. And for that reason, I personally believe that certainly fixed rate of exchange are absolutely indispensable. They may be inferior in a system where the monetary authorities are wise to flexible exchanges, but the reference to the necessity of maintaining exchange rates is almost the only defense monetary authorities have against the political pressure to do a little more inflation. And if you remove that one restraint, it's inevitable that they are being driven in an inflationary policy. Therefore, I believe that what is second best from an economic point of view may still be indispensable from a political point of view if you want to place the monetary authorities in a position where they can avoid doing greater harm.
I wonder if you could give some specific examples of the misdirection of labor activity associated with monetary expansion.
Well, that is actually, in our present situation, extraordinarily difficult. In the past, during the business cycles, it was comparatively simple, because then nearly all the credit expansion came by way of an expansion of credits for the purpose of industrial investment. So you had the typical overdevelopment of the production of iron and steel, of heavy machinery, of building, and they were the overdevelopments with an overattraction of labor. Now, the process of credit expansion during the last 25 years has only been partly of that character. It has come very largely by different routes. So I believe you can make no general statement about it. You would really have to analyze the situation separately for every country and even for every part of the epoch of 25 years. And what the net effect is, whether there still is any one large block of misdirected labor, or whether it's widely spread with all kinds of very specific things, whether what is more important is that overinvestment has been going into industries connected with investment, or in industries or trades where the expectation of a future rise of prices was a guiding factor. I simply do not know. The general model tells me that a great many misdirections must have occurred. In a simple situation, like the past business cycle, I can point to a class of industries. I know now it must be very dispersed. That may have the advantage that less serious. A widely dispersed misdirections may be easier to correct as a great block of misdirection, a great mass of labor drawn into capital goods industries and stuck there. I don't know if it is so or not. We'll only know if we find a way of establishing a new type of relatively stable equilibrium. But what sort of corrections that affords, I think the market is the only way of finding out.
I mean,
the chairman was very kind to me and gave all kinds of reasons for your speaking out, but he mentioned the main fact that I'm semi-deaf, which is really a good reason. I'm deaf, literally deaf on one ear, and the other, which you might amuse you, that I'm deaf on the left ear, has given rise to a great deal of joking about the political significance of this. And since I've since discovered that Karl Marx was deaf on the right ear, I'm beginning almost to believe it. But if you will speak up and speak so it can see your mouth, I think I shall be able to answer your question.
Oh, do you envision any kind of model building that could deal with this effect of overinvestment in certain sectors?
There is, of course, the model for the typical business cycle of the past based on industrial overinvestment, and I think you might build quite a number of models corresponding to the alternative methods of maintaining full employment which have been used. I mean, I believe you could possibly, at least for any one country, built a model on the assumption that it was all done by fiscal policy, by deficits or government spending. You might have another one that's assuming that's based all on low interest and private borrowing. And so you might build a number of models for different assumptions. Well, I'm not sure that it's very well worthwhile because they have such specific But I think, well, in a way, yes, anyone who wrote a history, an economic history, where he wants to explain what has happened, would really have to do that on the basis of a model based on realistic assumptions applying to that period of time.
Marx predicted this sort of misdirection of, in his idea of the self-expansion of capital, you see. Now, you seem to be saying, too, that the misdirection is between demand as it's actually distributed, where it goes into undue, what we have called Germany, rationalization, right? And what would be your alternative? I mean, how would it be ideally distributed?
Well, again, we don't have the concrete manifestation. We can only state the conditions in which it would be avoided. And that is, in very simple terms, really a condition in which currently the amount of funds available for investment is kept approximately equal to current voluntary savings. It's the old formula, try to keep investment in step with current voluntary savings, and you can hope to achieve some approach to an equilibrium situation.
Have you considered rewriting your book, The Road to Fortune, taking into consideration any recent trends towards socialism?
Again, I must ask you to speak up. I heard there's a question about my...
rewriting your book, The Road to Fortune, and taking into consideration any increasing trends towards socialism?
Have you considered rewriting The Road to Serfdom, taking into account trends towards socialism in the United States?
No, I couldn't do that again. That was in a very particular
flush of excitement about a problem. I wish somebody would do it. I think it's worth doing. But you cannot always write the books which may be wanted by the times. Your mind develops in a certain course, and I feel other things. I'm better qualified. In fact, I refused, actually, in again, if I may tell you a story, immediately after I had published The Road to Serfdom, or within 6 months, I was asked for a lecture tour over to this country. And in the course of this lecture tour, I was visited at one place by a gentleman who shall be anonymous for this purpose, who was trying to be very brief and said, "I'm not going to take up much of time. Oughtn't a book like this to be written specially for this country?" I said, "Yes." "Are you prepared to do it?" "No." "Could somebody else do it?" "Yes, probably, to give him 2 years and he's intimately acquainted with the conditions and fashion." "How much would it cost?" "Oh, I suppose at that time," I said, "engaging a first-class man who is interested in it for 2 years, with all the costs for $30,000, I think could be done. The money is yours." Well, I didn't find the money.
One of your primary arguments, a positive argument against socialism, is that it cannot work because of the informational quantity required by the planner is impossible to obtain. What about the counter argument of decentralized socialism or market socialism?
Well, I think it found us on one difficulty. It wouldn't be socialism if you didn't also decentralize the acquisition and formation of capital. And so long as the allocation of capital remains a matter for the central authority, you don't solve the problem. You see, they have never faced this fact, that if the decentralized industries are dependent for every new investment on what some central investment board is willing to give them, it is not in their power to restore a really competitive system. And if you allowed the individual firms to own their capital, it would really restore capitalism.
In other words, just being a capitalist country, the circuit factors over the work eliminated the bequeathing to your children the wealth from the factory. Only if you worked in the factory, you had to say in the allocation of the capital, what would be produced and how it would be priced and so on. You would not call that socialism.
I wouldn't. You see, if the ownership of capital was dispersed and you got, as you would in this case, substantial incomes from the return on capital, you would retain all those features of capitalism, which, so far as I can judge, the socialists most dislike. You would leave the distribution of incomes to the market, including to the pricing of capital, and to the accident of people being able to build up capital resources. I mean, I have, in these discussions in the 1930s, found some of my opponents being driven by the argument and practically proposing to restore capitalism. All they objected in the end is that, to begin with, capital ought not to be distributed by historical accident, but in some just manner. Which my answer is, of course, yes, to begin with you might have it, but if you let then the system work, in 5 years it is again distributed by the accidents of the market and no longer by justice, and you are back where you were.
Could you comment on the opportunity of direct involvement, direct subsidy by the government toward unemployment problems?
I don't know what these proposals are. Apparently you're referring to some American.
Well, there was a pool of experience in Germany back in the 1930s.
Are you just thinking of public works as means of creating employment?
That could be one method.
Well, that may in certain circumstances be necessary when it comes to the question of what I before called the secondary depression, that deflationary, cumulative deflationary process, which is started by the initial appearance of unemployment. In fact, I knew no other way of combating it except some form of public works, which in that case does. I knew that it also creates certain difficulties by potentially creating misdirections of labor. But if you employ these people on work, which is really only a temporary expedient, where they don't want to stay, but will be looking for something else, and at the same time use it only to give them an income so that the general demand for consumers' goods is maintained at approximately the kind they would have if these people were employed, I think this is still the best way out. But I should explain here one thing, because I have a reputation for things, advised things in the past, which is not fully justified, or which rather I can explain. See, I did actually argue in the 1930s, during the beginning of the Great Depression, that a deflationary process of some time had a function in restoring equilibrium. The reason for this was that already then, that rigidity of wages, which has now become a major problem, was making itself its first appearance. And I was hoping, probably wrongly, but for political consideration, that this wage rigidity, which made the market ineffective, might still be broken by a short process of deflation. Now, that's a matter of practical judgment. I no longer think now this is an effective means. I think we should have to find other means to restore a genuine labor market. But I admit that in the early 1930s, perhaps partly guided by observing the British experiment. See, the British had very honestly but foolishly tried in 1925 to return to the gold standard at the former parity, and had for 6 years stuck through a very painful process of deflation, which in the last 2 years had gone very far in bringing about a play in wages, fall of some wages, and if it had gone on, probably would have restored a wage structure which corresponds to equilibrium. They gave up in the acute crisis of 1931. I think in the belief that this hope of bringing real wages down had miscarried. And I think after that, it was hopeless to think that any government would again try this. That attempt was discredited, rightly or wrongly. And when I, in the early 1930s, still held the belief it was probably a political misjudgment. But I would just explain that it was for this reason, not for a general consideration, that I then did occasionally maintain that some little deflation might be a good thing.
The miserective labels that you're talking about and the miserative philosopher, doesn't come from an adaptive process after a long period of time. In this sense, you answer Professor Pinky that equalizing savings and investment will be a way to stop having a miseration of labor. But after 25 years that you have been having this miseration, isn't it true that this mind-directed label is already in the market, and it's part of the market, so that if you collide savings and investments, maybe you will mind-direct other labels, and not the one who was mind-directed originally? How could you know which is one?
What do you mean it is already part of the market? Of course it is a fact that the labor is in places
where it could not be kept in employment without the continuance of accelerating inflation. That means, in my opinion, that you cannot get a stable distribution of resources without some considerable redistribution. It is true that the new equilibrium, which we must hope to achieve, will have among its determinants certain capital accumulations which have happened in the interval. It will not be the same which we would have achieved if we had not inflated and had achieved the equilibrium in 1925. There are new data which determine the present equilibrium in the form of the particular kinds of capital goods which have been created in the interval. But it's still a problem of adjusting the distribution of labor to these data which now exist and which we must accept. And the thing is, I believe, that this will involve that a good many people cannot hope to continue in their present jobs. And if they are to find durable employment, must move elsewhere.
Given your current belief that it's politically unlikely that we can solve aggregate problems and the problem of relative prices through deflation, I'd like to know what, in your opinion, stops relative prices from adjusting to their proper level in the process of a purely monetary inflation.
The fact that price changes happen not at the same time, but successively in a certain order. The additional money comes in at some point of the economic system, hits certain prices first, and reaches others only very late. And while this proceeds, there is a constant, what shall I call it, inclination in the price system, with those which are hit first, always somewhat ahead, and those which are reached last, always in the end. And this distortion of the whole price system can be corrected only if this extra influx at some point, or some points nowadays, stops. I sometimes use a homely simile, which perhaps helps you to see what I have in mind. The effect of a change in the quantity of money on the price structure can be compared to the effect of a stream of syrup into a pot of syrup when the thing falls into the middle. You will have a little hill in the middle which gradually spreads to the side. And so long as the stream of additional syrup lasts, you still have this distortion and no equal level. It's only when the stream stops that it will level out again. So while inflation lasts, the price structure is always distorted. Just as while the influx of syrup lasts, the level of the surface is always distorted.
Could I just add one partial question to that? You feel this is true even in the face of inflationary pressure through consumer credit? In the earlier distortions, the initiation of business cycles, it was often because of the point of injection of additional spending power, which led to an overinvestment in capital goods. But we're often asserted to have a consumer-oriented inflation with the expansion of consumer credit.
It certainly is, in my opinion, but of course it leads in the most controversial theoretical issue which exists in this field. The fact whether changes in the level of consumer prices are automatically transmitted to the prices in the higher levels, or whether there is a possible change of this relationship. I mean, some of you may have come across the concept of the Ricardo effect, which bases itself very largely on the fact that a change in the relationship between the prices of consumers' goods and the prices of factors has a profound effect on the volume of investment. So it may well be that an increase in the demand for consumers' goods may have very deep effects. I would say not attempt merely to maintain the demand of consumers' goods at a level where the crisis of consumer goods was the key at the state. And that's what I had before in mind. That's the purpose for which I would employ public works if an actual deflation threatened. I would have the public works essentially to create a source for money to spend on consumer goods. People are the building ones.
I'm a little worried about the concept of equilibrium.
We all are.
There's a figment of the human imagination, and the real world, of course, it never exists. It is sort of the world as an evolutionary system. Although it's a very useful figment, I'm not sure it's right. I have a great deal of sympathy with the view you express that the structural problems of societies are not necessarily solved by these overall aggregate measures. The only difficulty is that the aggregate measures seem to be all we know how to do. I think that, by the way, I can put this in a question. If I ask why was the Keynesian revolution so successful politically, whereas the view which you represent in a sense was not. And that, well, is that right? Let me ask you, because I'm not being ad hominem. I think this is back to the last 25 years.
I'm trying as much as you to avoid the concept of equilibrium because I appreciate its misleading character. And yet there isn't a simple, short, other term which you can use. We need a description for a state of affairs in which the activities of the different members of an economic system are so adjusted to each other that each has at least a good chance that its expectations will be met. Now that's what we like to achieve, and our policy aims at bringing out something like that. This sort of state has first been described by the mathematical economists by applying the term equilibrium to it, and we haven't got a better term. I would very much prefer to have another term, and in my present writings, when I speak of equilibrium, I generally put it in inverted commas, I think as you do, too, for the same reasons. But it's a general dilemma in getting a rather complex set of ideas over. Should you use an oversimplified explanation which is readily intelligible, or should you be very careful, cautious, and introduce all your provisos and hesitations you have about them, with the result that the reader either gets lost or thinks, well, that's all very muddled and unclear. We prefer something simple. At the present moment, nobody could be more, irritated by the current oversimplification in economics than I, except perhaps Professor Bolding. He may be more irritated by it. We have this in common. But we mustn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We must occasionally simplify, even if we know that simplification is half wrong.
I'd like to make this, if we could, the last question, because the present last time. If I may follow up on Professor Bolden's question, to what extent do you view the work of economists such as Pinkin, Fowler, and Leonovich on the disequilibrium rather than equilibrium of output and employment, a proper approach to better understanding what you call the improper distribution of output and employment?
I think they are a great improvement on the crude acceptance of a macroanalysis by Keynes and the Keynesians proper. They really are a step in a return to a microanalysis, which I think is all the real knowledge we have. I think all the macroanalysis or macrodynamics are rough approximation which we have temporarily adopted because they help us to deal with the statistical data which we have, but which are really very misleading. I mean, let me just add one thing. You know, the reason why when Keynes
published his general theory, which became his most influential book, I did not return to the charge. I did not devote as much effort to criticizing as I had done earlier, because I didn't at once realize that the main difference was no longer a difference of particular points of detail, but that the book really marked the transition from microeconomics to macroeconomics. It took me years to find it out, that what I would have to do is not to criticize Keynes' particular form of macroeconomics, but my objections were against macroeconomics as such.
Well, I'm sure that we all extend our thanks to Professor Hayek.